Another opening, another show.
In Philly, Boston, or Baltimore,
a chance for stage folks to say hello.
Another opening of another show.
Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Moya Andrews, and today we have the opportunity to meet an individual who plays an important part in the world of theater. He is Professor Murray McGibbon from our Campus Department of Theater and Drama, but he is originally from South Africa. So, Murray, welcome to Profiles. It's our pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks, Moya. It's great to be here.
Now, you're a professor in our own Department of Theater and Drama on campus, and so I suppose you've directed quite a number of shows since you've been here.
Yes, I've directed 21.
Well, that's a large number. Does every member of the faculty direct a show every year?
No. Members of the Acting and Directing Committee are expected to direct one show per annum, but I've done a little bit of double duty on some years and also directed at the Brown County Playhouse, which explains the large number. I've also directed one production overseas, which was the first time we've had a production play in a foreign country. So that's one of the 21 shows.
I see. Now, the one overseas, I believe, was in South Africa in the summer of 2007. Can you tell us how that came about?
Yes. Well, a couple of years ago, I applied for a New Frontiers grant through IU, sponsored by the Lilly Endowment, to create an African version of The Tempest. I'd had this idea for a long time to stage Shakespeare's The Tempest on a mythical island off the coast of South Africa. I won this huge grant from IU and took six students from here to South Africa for 2 months, and we teamed up with 14 students from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Pietermaritzburg and had a glorious time discovering the play, workshopping the performances, working with a professional actor, Stephen Gurney, who played Prospero. And it was just an extraordinary experience for all of us, particularly for our IU students who lived and worked in a foreign country for that time.
Did they actually live on the campus of the South African University?
Yes, I organized accommodation within walking distance of the theater on the campus. So they all lived together in two faculty housing units. And I stayed in a small apartment close by. So we were all, you know, a little community of South Africans and Indiana students.
And some
together.
Of the students, I suppose, had not been abroad before.
No, for some of them, it was their first time on an aeroplane.
That must have been an exciting experience for them. And I suppose you also did other things while they were there to explore the culture with them.
Yes, well, it was important for me that it was a broadly educational experience, not just going to Pietermaritzburg, which is a landlocked town, to work on a Shakespeare production. But I wanted them to have, you know, firsthand experience of what it was to be in South Africa, to experience some of the natural beauty. So every weekend I organized expeditions away from the city, and we piled into a van and drove up to the mountains, went down to the ocean, and took them to a game preserve where we were able, lucky enough, to see lion in the wild on our last day. So they were able to really get into the wilds of Africa and see animals that they'd only previously seen in zoos or circuses. And that was a great thrill for me to see the enjoyment and excitement that they experienced. I think for many of those students, this will be a life-changing experience and certainly one they'll never forget.
Oh, I would imagine that's so. And each day they would work on the script and you would have rehearsals, I suppose, for a large part of the time.
Yes, well, we had a very demanding schedule. They would arrive at work at 9 o'clock in the morning, and from 9 until 10 they did a voice and movement workshop. They had a tea break till about 10:15, and then I would start working with them on the script. And we'd take a break for lunch and then work through to 5 o'clock every day. And what was interesting about the production was that all the actors, including the professional Stephen, and myself built the set, built the props, helped make the costumes. Everybody was involved. There was no sort of star class system at all. Everyone was involved in the entire production. And what I'd wanted to do was to have a large amount of time to make mistakes, to select work, reject work, try things again. You know, often when one's working on a production, you've got 3 or 4 weeks from day one to opening night. And so you're working under enormous time constraints and pressure. And part of the reason for applying for this grant was to give me time to really explore the text with no pressure at all.
And so this was a larger project. It was an educational experience that was deliberately planned with pedagogical objectives.
Yes, I didn't realize how educational it was going to be for me. Just the logistics of getting six people across to South Africa, organizing the air tickets and, you know, the accommodation and the transport. And it was a huge administrative, not nightmare, because I enjoy administration very much, but it was a huge job. So I wasn't only directing, but teaching and being a mother, a father, a disciplinarian. It was an enormous experience for all of us, and one that I would be very eager to undertake again, because I think it's really important for students to get an international perspective, to have ideas of how people work in other places and how theater is done in other places. You know, people are here of obviously in the American model, but there are other ways of creating plays, of staging work. And I think they had their eyes opened considerably by the very informal way in which South Africans tend to approach the artistic process.
I believe they even used all the textiles were African.
Yes, some of the fabrics were actually manufactured and cobbled together by a wonderful designer, Mbo Mchali, from the university there, who designed the costumes, an extraordinarily talented young man. And it's my hope that we'll be able to bring him here to IU in the next year or two to remount the production in reverse, so that we'll use the bulk of our students here and bring 6 or 7 South Africans to Bloemington to recreate the production. We won't need such a long rehearsal period since we've already now created the play. We'll keep the original staging. But that's part two, hopefully, of this exciting project.
Well, how on earth did you come up with it? I mean, what were you sitting in your office one day and you said, gee, I'd like to do The Tempest and take it to South Africa?
Well, it's a funny story, because I just sort of come up with this idea. I just received tenure and I thought, well, I now need to do something. And I'd had The Tempest sort of lurking in the back of my mind for quite a long time. It's a magical play, and it's a difficult play. I think it's a poem, perhaps more than a play. And I'm often drawn to difficult projects, and why I try and terrorize myself, I don't know. But, it was something that I had to conquer, because the play had always conquered me. I had left many productions of The Tempest at intermission thinking, this is just not working. And so I was determined to find a way that I could make it work. And the more that I got into the text, and I absolutely adore Shakespeare, the more I realized that this was a play that could speak to South African audiences right now. Thinking of what that country has gone through over the last 10, 15 years in the transition from the nationalist-dominated political regime to a free and fair, open, democratic society. And the play talks about redemption and healing and forgiveness, and those are things very uppermost in the South African psyche at the moment. So I thought it was an ideal vehicle to present in South Africa. I originally, funnily enough, I decided to produce the play here, submitted it to the drama department, and they said, this is way too big a project. We can't do it. It's too ambitious, and we don't think that the Lilly Endowment will accept the project, and on that basis we'll approve it and send it through. So I was very delighted when, we got it.
And so then you thought about taking students from here and using an international kind of a cast.
Yes, well, I said, if we can't do it here, could I try and do it abroad? And that's how that occurred. I had contacts at the Hexagon Theatre, where I'd done my training as an undergraduate. And it's a beautiful theatre seating about 500 people in an arena setting. And that's what I wanted to do, was to create an island in the middle of the theatre. So it wasn't a proscenium staging. We had audience seated all the way around. And so the stage was the island of the play. And so it was a very intimate, despite the large size of the theatre, it was an intimate staging of the play. And you could visibly hear people breathe in the audience and gasp at the startling relevance of the text. So for me, it was a wonderful, wonderful theatrical experience.
Well, let's have some South African music. I believe you brought the South African National Anthem with you today.
Yes, this is an unusual rendition of it played by the marimba instrument.
That was certainly very lovely. Now, tell me, Murray, how long have you been in the United States? You are South African by birth, obviously. And how long have you been in the United States?
Well, I've had two stays here. I originally came on a Fulbright in 1983, I think it was, to do my master's in acting and directing at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And then I returned to South Africa for 10 years and worked in professional theater then there. And then came back in 1996. So I've been here 11 years now.
Now, do you return to South Africa frequently?
I do. I still have family there, and I have a home there. And I think my body left South Africa, but I think my heart might still be there. It's important for me, with two young kids who were born in the United States, that they also understand their South African roots and get to meet their family on a regular basis. I also direct there. I've directed three or four shows since I've been a faculty member at IU. So I keep a finger on the pulse and keep up to date with what's happening in the theatrical circles there.
What follow-up and dissemination projects have you organized so that the Tempest project will be useful and create insights for other people here in the States?
Well, a number of articles are being written about the play at the moment and disseminated to major magazines around the world. There's also been interest in South Africa from the Shakespeare Society of Southern Africa for me to give a talk at their next convention, which will be held in the summer of 2008. We filmed the entire process. On a daily basis, I took a documentary filmmaker from IU to South Africa, and she filmed the entire process. And we're in the process at the moment of creating a documentary. It's perhaps a little premature to know whether that will be something that I can show at theatre conferences or whether it will be of sufficiently high standard to broadcast. And then we've also filmed the entire production, and I want to bring out a DVD of the play, so that people will be able to see it on film.
Well, I saw some of the reviews, and they certainly were very glowing. And what was nice, I think, was that the headlines in the South African newspapers mentioned Indiana University and the Lilly Foundation.
Yes, it was quite exciting on the poster to see University of KwaZulu-Natal and Indiana University Bloomington presents The Tempest. That was very exciting. And our chair, Jonathan Michelson, was able to come across for 2 weeks to work on Shakespearean voice text with principally the South Africans, but also the Americans. So it was really terrific to have an Indiana contingent there and to see that our classroom really is the world. It's not just concerned with being in a studio here on the Bloomington campus, but indeed we can take theater anywhere.
And the students, what kinds of things did they say that gave you the impression that they had really been changed by the experience of working with students of another nationality?
Well, I think, you know, they all wrote a written report after the play, and just reading through these reports, you left with an overriding impression that this was an experience that superseded their expectations, that they didn't really know what they were going for or going into. I think a lot of them thought that we were going to be living in mud huts and sleeping on grass reeds. And in fact, they had the opportunity of going into Zulu villages and seeing how people lived. But to see that South Africa is actually quite a remarkably developed country and very first world in many aspects, and then, you know, is also very run down and depressed, and poverty and hunger and a lot of the things you find in the United States, but perhaps several degrees worse. For me, it was fascinating watching them interact because for whatever reasons, I think the Americans felt a little uncomfortable going into a foreign country not knowing how they were going to be received. You know, I think America is dealing with a lot of issues internationally at the moment, and so the Americans were concerned. And the South Africans just embraced them. They took them to their hearts. And that was very exhilarating and deeply moving to see. So, you know, I think theater touches the psyche, it touches the heart, and those actors touched each other and in turn touched the audiences who just really lapped up the play.
That's wonderful, and we hope that there'll be more of these projects so that more students will have the experience. I believe you brought another piece of music. Can you tell us about that? Consider yourself at home?
Well, Oliver, the musical from which that comes, was the first professional show that I acted in and have directed it several times. It's always been very close to my heart. And a couple of years ago, Her Majesty the Queen and His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, came to South Africa on their first state visit after Nelson Mandela was swept to power. And the British government asked me if I would create a sort of Night of 100 Stars variety concert featuring the top South African talent. And the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh were to be the guests of honor at this performance. And I had the pleasure of meeting her after the show and took her up on stage in full view of the audience, and the orchestra struck up Consider Yourself at Home, which I thought was very appropriate for the Queen, who had celebrated her 21st birthday in South Africa and had not returned to those shores during all the years of apartheid. And she just looked at me with tears in her eyes as this music was played. So that's what I've brought in.
I've taken to you so strong. It's clear we're going to get along. Consider yourself well in. Consider yourself part of the furniture. There isn't a lot to spare. Who cares whatever we got we share? If it's your chance to be, we should see some harder days. Empty larder days, white grouse. Always a chance we'll meet somebody to foot the bill. Then the drinks are on the house. Consider yourself our mate.
This is Moya Andrews, and today I'm speaking with Professor Murray McGibbon from the Theatre Department at Indiana University. And we've just heard a wonderful music selection that Murray brought in, Consider Yourself at Home, from Oliver. And this music was played when he had the occasion to meet the Queen of England during one of his productions in South Africa. Murray, tell us a little bit about what you did in South Africa before you came to IU to join the faculty here.
Well, when I finished my MFA in the United States, I returned to South Africa and was offered a wonderful job as manager of the Loft Theatre Company at what was then called the Natal Performing Arts Council. There were four regional arts councils in South Africa, of which this was one. And we had quite an extraordinary complex of 5 theatres in 2 big buildings side by side in downtown Durban. And the combined capacity, I think, of those theatres was around 2,500 people. So on any one evening, you'd have 2,500 people seeing anything from a symphony concert to a children's play. And I was head of the Loft Theatre Company, which was an experimental company of young actors who just graduated, and it was a sort of feeder company into the profession. Actors would join us for 2 years, and it was a fixed 2-year contract, and every year we'd bring in another 7 actors, so there was some overlap. And our goal was to create new South African work. During the 10 years I was there, we created 90 new South African plays, and also did a lot of classical work, but with a twist. Looking at old classics through new eyes and trying to make them accessible to a modern audience. It was a very exhilarating time. I was blessed with an enormous budget, and my job was to lose money responsibly. We were not box office driven. We were a subsidized company trying to create a new genre of South African work. And the artistic director of the drama company retired while I was there, and I was then offered the artistic directorship of the entire drama company. And I think I was about 30 at the time and was woefully unprepared and inexperienced for the job, but somehow you just had to, you know, paddle like, swim like hell. And it was a terrific experience for me. I learned a lot, grew a lot. And I was suddenly flying around the world, flying in artists, bringing in shows to South Africa. It was just extraordinary. And I had a lot of directing experience there, directed over 40 productions, ranging from huge Shakespearean productions like Hamlet to small cabaret shows with 2 or 3 singers in them. The whole works. And I had complete artistic and administrative control of this company during sort of the fading days of the nationalist government. The Arts Council's funding was severely curtailed, and those companies no longer exist, and for good reason. The present government has got other priorities, but sadly, with the withholding of funding, so those companies disbanded. And it was then that I came to the United States.
I see. And I believe you've also won awards similar to Grammys or Tonys for some of the shows that you've directed in South Africa. And some of them are still running, I believe.
Well, the South African theatre industry is considerably smaller than this country, but there is a national awards system. It used to be called the Vita Awards, and I won 5 of those for various productions. Last year, the name of the award was changed to the Naledi, and I won Best Production of a Review for Black Mamba, which is a political satire that I directed, 3 years ago now, and it is still running, can you believe, which makes my bank manager very happy every Friday morning when the royalties for the week come in. It's been phenomenally successful and has toured throughout South Africa several times. We are looking at the moment of the possibility of doing a transfer to London of the production, which will be wonderful because there's a large expatriate population in London. And I think we'll be able to do good business there for a couple of weeks or months. So that's the show that's still running. But, you know, awards, I think, they're fun to receive, but you know, when they talk about best director, I don't know about that. I accept the award as director of the piece. It's nice to get that recognition. But in theatre, it's a collaborative act. So many people are responsible for the success of those productions. It's not just you. You can't do it on your own. You're dependent upon all your technical personnel, your stage management, the designers, the performers, the marketing people. So I suppose when you receive an award, you're receiving it really on behalf of all those people.
I'm sure your experiences in the real world of theatre and drama informs what you do in the classroom and what you do with your students. Can you talk a little bit about how this collaborative process that theatre really is a helpful vehicle for student learning?
Well, I think theatre promotes teamwork in very much the same way as sport does. I was no good at sport at all at school. And I was always the last kid to be picked, you know, when they had to choose a team, I'd be the last person chosen. And I came from a very sporting family. And it was only, I think, when I got involved in drama that I came into my own as an individual. I had a stutter as a kid, and you might even hear me on this program. Here I go. When I start to think about it, get a slight stutter. And my parents took me to a speech therapist, and I started playing with puppets. And the puppets wouldn't stutter. That was a segue into performing in plays. And when I performed in a play, I wouldn't stutter. And the team spirit that I missed in sport, I think I got in the theatre, because it's a highly disciplined occupation. And I think the value of theatre in the classroom just can't be underestimated. Right from grade one, I believe that play should be encouraged. And if I had my way, I'd have drama as a compulsory subject in the schoolroom. I taught drama at a South African boys' high school for many years before I went into the profession. And it was amazing to see how drama could affect a young people's lives in extraordinary ways, that they were able to assume greater confidence in themselves, became more effective communicators, and all-round better people. And so I'm very, very passionate about drama as an educational tool, which can be used not just in the classroom of an acting class, but drama through, you know, in the English classroom, in geography and history, in acting historical moments. And so I think as an actor, because I think that's primarily what I am, in the classroom I'm probably acting Professor McGibbon. And my goal now, I suppose, is to sort of spread the knowledge, spread the enthusiasm, and to get my students to be not disciples, but to be as excited as I am, and to re-energize American classrooms and American theater. And I think I've had a lot of success with that. A lot of my students are working around the world in prestigious companies, some of which they formed themselves. And it's really gratifying when I go to New York and see my students' names up in lights, or go and see a production that they have created. And they'll say to me, you know, that all started in your directing class back in Bloomington, Indiana. And It's very rewarding.
You sound as though you might have been influenced a little bit by Peter Slade, because I imagine that the South African schools would be a little similar to the British schools.
Yes. Well, Peter Slade was de rigueur when I was doing my bachelor's degree in South Africa. I think drama in education and theatre in education are really fundamental to the educational process, certainly from my perspective.
You seem to be, though, especially creative and innovative, and we can't expect that every student will be as innovative as someone like you. How do you believe you became such a creative person? Is creativity innate, or can it be fostered?
You see, I don't know whether I am terribly creative or innovative, really. I think I'm extremely stubborn and persistent. And when people say, you know, well, you seem to have been successful, what do you attribute your success? I say staying power, which you have to have in the theater. You've got to just stick with it, because there are so many detractors, and it's so easily to be demotivated or humiliated by a bad review in the press. It's a very public failure in the theatre. And so I think just being stubborn and obstinate has got me more places than creativity. But having said that, I think that to create an atmosphere where students are not afraid of failure can help them to be creative. Let me give you an example. When I was doing my student teaching in South Africa, I taught a group of high school English students who were big, tough, thug, rugby-playing boys at Maritzburg College, who were doing very, very badly in the English classroom. Their teacher said, you'll not get anything out of these kids. They're not interested in literature. They're certainly not interested in being in school. And I went into the classroom and just slightly overcompensated in my grading. And they thought, you know, I'm getting a B from you when I would get an F from Mr. Howard. And some of those kids went on to get first-class passes in English when they matriculated from school, simply because they were told, you're not as bad as you think you are. I tried to boost them and to give them some confidence and some belief in themselves.
Let's take a break here and play another music selection that you brought. There's no business like show business. You've been involved in show business all of your life. But was there any other reason why you selected this?
Well, I think it's a, I don't know, it reminds me of my life. You know, I was pretty well born into the theater. At the age of three, at kindergarten, we were putting on an end-of-year concert, and the teacher who was conducting us was ill that day, and we were told that we couldn't perform. So I went to the head teacher and said, well, I'll conduct the band. And she said, you? And I said, yes. So I stood on this podium and conducted away. And it was just this extraordinary experience to be in control of this little band. I can't remember what we were playing. But the smell of velvet curtains and makeup backstage and the heat of the lights was just intoxicating to me. And I knew that I'd entered a world that I never wanted to leave. And, you know, in many ways, I regret the fact that I don't know so many other things about the world. It's my life has really been centered around the performing arts. And I've had a glorious time doing it. I've seen the world pretty well for free as a director and as an actor. But I suppose it's a bug. It's a theater bug that bites. It's in your blood.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything that traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low, even with a turkey that you know will fold. You may be stranded out in the cold, still you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold. Let's go on with a show.
That was No Business Like Show Business from Annie Get Your Gun, and this is Moya Andrews, and I'm talking with Professor Murray McGibbon from the Theatre and Drama Department on the Bloomington campus. Murray, tell us a little bit about your early life growing up in South Africa and that kind of experience in a different world than we know here.
Well, I didn't know that it was different at the time because I grew up on a farm outside Pietermaritzburg. And had a very idyllic childhood with cows and chickens and horses and lived on this beautiful farm, went into school in the city every day. And I think it was only when I got into high school I started to realize that South Africa was, you know, severely handicapped with enormous political and social problems. And when I got to university, that was exacerbated, of course, with the riots of 1976. The Sharpeville massacre, and I was very politically active on campus, in fact was detained by the security police on several occasions. I can remember one occasion when we were protesting for Nelson Mandela's release, and I was chained to the gates with handcuffs, which the police had to cut us free from, at the gates of the University of Natal. I suppose apartheid was very successful in keeping us apart, in the fact that we didn't mix with black people. I never had black friends. The only black people I knew were laborers and workers. You know, I realized that something was really severely wrong. And so I took an active stand against the government. But then I was faced with this awful dilemma of having to undergo my national service, which was a legal requirement in those days. So after I qualified as a high school teacher, there was no option but to go into the army for 2 years. And I refused to carry a rifle. I wasn't strong enough to be a conscientious objector, which my brother-in-law had been, and he was imprisoned for 6 years. And I saw what that did to him. So I agreed to wear the uniform but not to carry a rifle. And so I was used by the South African Army as a teacher and was taken into black schools. And in fact, I taught in the operational area of the Caprivi Strip in uniform, little Bushman kids who were the children of people in the battalion based up in that area. And I taught there for a year and was then sent to teach chemistry and physical science, for which I had no professional qualification, at the matriculation level at a black school outside Pietermaritzburg. You know, it was really dangerous times. One was subjected to gunfire, and it was really just terrible. And it got to the point when I seriously considered leaving South Africa. And then I thought, no, I should actually stay and make a difference. And the difference came through theater, where we were able to change, I think, the hearts and minds of people through presenting alternatives, largely through Ethel Fugard's plays, which were initially banned by the South African government. We found ways of presenting these in small halls and church halls and in townships. And I really do believe that the performing arts in South Africa played a major role in getting black and white people to talk to each other and to realize that we had far more in common than we had apart. And the miracle of South Africa, I think, is that it has turned out to be a remarkable democracy. Our constitution, I think, almost rivals that of the United States. When you think that gay rights are enshrined in the South African constitution, that is extraordinarily progressive. One doesn't want to paint such a rosy picture that everything is right in South Africa. There are still enormous problems to be overcome. But the fact that it didn't turn out to be a terribly bloody revolution is an extraordinary miracle. And I think that was solely due to people getting around a table and being able to communicate effectively and to understand people's points of view, particularly Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk, of course, the president at the time. Theater certainly played a huge role in being able to heal a divided society.
This is really interesting for all of us on many levels, the effect that theater can have on an individual and a developing concept of self, the effect that theater can have on a country and a community, a culture. President Mugabe has emphasized his interest in international and in excellence in the arts and humanities on the Bloomington campus. How can individual faculty do more to make sure that students have these cultural experiences as well as international experiences?
Well, I think it starts, for me, with the theater department on campus, getting to know who our audience is and attracting students. I think that is one of our biggest challenges at the moment. We have a wonderful supporters group, theater circle members, who support our theater. But my mission is to get in those students who are studying biology or physics or in the business school into the theater. And how do we do that? Because I think that it's extremely important in the development of a student that they become active theater goers while they're at university. If we lose them and they're not exposed to the benefits of theater at this age, I think we've lost them pretty well
for
good.
But what could we do? What can individual faculty do?
Well, one of the ideas I've had, and I've spoken about this in my directing class, is having a student performing arts fee added to the bursar's bill so that any student could show their ticket at the box office and get a seat free of charge, essentially. With so many students on the Bloomington campus, we'd have completely full houses. But what I think is really important for the theater department to do is to identify their target audience. And that, for me, is the student on the Bloomington campus. And so our play selection needs to target the I don't know, 18 to 30 age group. You know, what is exciting for those people? How can we take classical work and reconfigure it and make it relevant for a modern audience? The days of creating a Shakespearean production in Elizabethan dress as a museum piece, for me, I think, are over. The development of new American plays. I think the state of American theater is in a fairly parlous state at the moment. And I'm surprised that after September 11th that there hasn't been a great new American play. Hopefully it's being written at the moment. But we're tending to look to Europe, to Australia, even to South Africa for new plays. We need to be developing a strong new American theater. I asked a student of mine the other day to name a groundbreaking American play written in the last 10 years, and they were completely stumped. If I'd said the last 15 years, the answer would have been Angels in America. But we're still waiting for that great post-9/11 play. I think a lot of playwrights write for the film rather than for the theater. Of course, there's money in film, but the theater is such an exciting, immediate place to work. I mean, I find film, you know, it can be spectacular, but the theatrical moment, the excitement of that theatrical experience when a body of people are touched by something that occurs like a bolt of electricity in a theater is a rare and very special human experience.
And we would hope that most students who came to IU would take advantage of the opportunities to attend all of the live events in the music school and in the theater department, and also visit the museums more than they do. Individual faculty members do try. I know that many ask students to go to performances and to write papers for special credit. And hopefully more of this will be done so that the rich resources on this campus can be shared. Murray, let's talk philosophically here for a little while. What does theater really mean to you?
Theater plumbs the depths of humanity so that we may better understand, reflect upon, and celebrate the human condition. That's what it means to me. It's about being human and being in life.
So that means, of course, that theater doesn't always have to be a comedy.
No, if we can make people laugh or cry, that's great. You know, I think I often say I get moved to tears in the movies and bored to tears in the theater. And so it's my goal and mission to reinvigorate the theater so that it can be something absolutely essential to people's lives. It's not a luxury. It's not something that's just tacked on. Picasso said that art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday living. And with art in our lives, with performing arts in our lives, I believe we can be more effective, compassionate, understanding, useful human beings. You know, Michael McRobbie's idea for the development of the arts here is one of the things that keeps me in Bloomington. And I'm very excited about his initiatives.
Now tell me a little bit about your family. You have two young children.
I do, James 11 and Catherine 8, neither of whom I'm encouraging to go into the theater. And you can tell why when you listen to the next bit of music, which is written by one of my favorite playwrights. Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington.
Well, that will be our last music selection, which brings us to the conclusion of this interview. Our guest today was Murray McGibbon from the Department of Theater and Drama. Murray, thank you for spending time with us today and for sharing your thoughts with our WFIU audience. I'm Moya Andrews, and thanks for listening.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded, and the struggle is pretty tough.
and admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage. Regarding yours, dear Mrs. Worthington, of Wednesday the 23rd, although your baby may be keen on a stage career, how can I make it clear this is not a good idea for her to hope, dear Mrs. Worthington, is on the face of it absurd. Her personality is not in reality.
The program you just heard was recorded in November of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.